Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
In Denver, Colorado, Jamie Sanchez obeyed the Lord's call and opened the Drip Cafe to create jobs to help unhoused people get back on their feet. Of course, the LGBTQ community began persecuting him for his Christian beliefs. His inspiring story of standing boldly for God's truth in the face of great opposition is part of our Impact Series, and we'll send you the DVD as our thanks for your gift to AFA. Visit afa.net/spiritualwar. afa.net/spiritualwar.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, April 23rd. A lot of things going on, including the left continuing to attack the Trump administration and make a very big deal out of the second signal gate, is what it's now being called, with Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense. And information, according to The Hill, is shared on a second signal chat, informal and unclassified. So Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is defending himself after he shared information in a second signal group chat with family members and his personal lawyer, arguing the messages were informal and unclassified. Hegseth maintained no war plans were shared in the chat, and he said regarding the first controversial signal chat, in which a journalist, you'll recall, from The Atlantic was included alongside members of the White House national security team discussing strikes being carried out on Houthi rebels in Yemen. So is this a big deal? Is this just the left trying to attack Hegseth and sort of force his hand in terms of resignation? I don't think that Donald Trump would actually go so far as to fire him, because that would then create a PR mess for Donald Trump himself. It would be more something along the lines of Hegseth suddenly having, you know, family concerns and can't fulfill his obligations, et cetera, et cetera. But should it come down to that? Well, let's welcome in former Congressman Bob Good, who was the former chair of the Freedom Caucus and a former Virginia congressman. And good morning, Representative Good. And you know, this to me just seems like a little bit much ado about nothing, because everybody in D.C. uses Signal. Having a group chat isn't necessarily something that we should all be looking at Hegseth saying that this is irresponsible. But is there potentially more to the story?
Good morning, Jenna. Great to be with you. Thanks for having me again. I think you're spot on in how you're describing this. The Democrats and the mainstream media, which is an extension of the Democrat Party, as we know, they are losing on every issue. They're doubling down on their losing issues. They're floundering without a message, without a path, if you will, to flip the debate to their favor or to undo the harm that they've done to their national brand. And so they're grasping and reaching and striving at silly things, with attacks on Elon Musk, with attacks on Pete Hegseth, and so forth. And while I don't know exactly what, you know, communication Secretary Hegseth has had with family or his lawyer, what have you, obviously, he maintains that these allegations are false. He maintains they didn't share any classified information. I will confirm what you said just a moment ago. When I was in Congress, we did use Signal to communicate among members of Congress. We used that for group chats because it was understood and believed that was more secure than other means of communication. Matter of fact, we moved to Signal from another similar app that was supposed to be secure, but the Signal was better. But that was our primary communication among a group, was through Signal. And so that is common, as you said, in D.C. Pete Hegseth is doing a great job with refocusing our military on warfighting capability and away from the wokeness, the focus on climate, the focus on diversity, or the wrong kind of diversity for the wrong kind of reasons, the focus on critical race theory and DEI and transgenderism and paying for abortions, those kind of things. And hopefully he's going to do a great job of making the military and our Defense Department more accountable, more efficient, more effective, and to be better stewards of taxpayer dollars, and to be an even and to repair the damage that was done over the 4 years of my administration.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're spot on that because Hegseth is looking to reform the military and the DOD in a lot of these very conservative ways, and this aligns with the Trump mandate, then it's no wonder he's being attacked and the left is trying to create this PR nightmare, because they do know that Trump doesn't like PR nightmares. And so eventually, if the analysis or the calculation is that it's more of a headache than it would be just to replace him, that that's something that they're pushing for in the media. And I personally hope that that the Trump administration is wiser now in their second term to not really care about all of that. And yet, should Hegseth and the DOD, instead of responding to these lines of attacks and sort of keeping this in the news, shouldn't he just respond with, well, you know, these are all frivolous attacks, look at what we're doing, and push out all of these good things and force the media to air those comments, because that's really what the majority of the American people and certainly the MAGA base prefer?
Yes, and I think you were right in what you said a few moments ago, that they're just looking for a scalp, they're looking to distract, they're looking for something to talk about. And foolish it would be for the Trump administration to think, oh, well, if we gave up this one person, then we could get back focused. No, that would just feed the sharks, feed the media frenzy, if you will. And I will also add that there are Republicans who in Congress who are uncomfortable with the things that the Trump administration, DOGE, Pete Hegseth, and the Defense Department, so forth, are doing to bring accountability, transparency, efficiency, to reduce costs, to shrink government where we can. That's why you've got people like Don Bacon from Nebraska, who's one of the most liberal members of the Republican delegation, who thinks it helps him to be sort of anti-Trump. And, you know, these guys, they get on these committees where the dollars flow in from the defense military industrial complex, and they want to grow and expand with no accountability or transparency, military spending and defense spending and for the contractors and where the jobs are and where the money comes from and so forth. And they don't want the kind of accountability that Pete Hegseth and others in the Trump administration are bringing to the Defense Department.
I'm speaking with former Representative Bob Good from the great state of Virginia. And speaking of accountability, Hegseth even said during a recent Fox News interview that the Defense Department takes the classification of information seriously, and pointed to the department's investigation into leaks that led to the firings of those three employees who were very senior advisors and even his own chief of staff. And that's another contrast, I think, between the first Trump administration and this second, is that they are not tolerating leakers. I mean, when I was around the first Trump administration, there was nothing that could ever be behind closed doors, even meetings or discussions, that didn't eventually make their way into the press, which ultimately undermined the agenda. And it would cause chaos by saying, oh, look, different people have different opinions. Well, that's how politics works, because you all get together, you have different ideas, and then all take the decision from your commander in chief and see, okay, what does ultimately the boss want to do? But these firings, I think it is a good indication that Hegseth is taking this seriously, and that the administration overall isn't going to tolerate what happened during the first term.
Yes, I think there's great improvement over the first term in that respect. As you said, one of the best things the Trump administration has done is to bring more accountability to federal employees, to try to work to make more federal employees fireable, replaceable when there's a change in administration, to require that federal employees do support in their professional capacity the work being done by the president, who's elected by the people, the head of the executive branch. It's their job to help him carry out his policies, to implement his agenda, because that's what the American people voted for. And so that is great that they're doing that. It needs to, you know, go on warp speed and do even more. And when you're going fast and when you're going hard, you're going to make some mistakes. Obviously, we're all imperfect, but that is a great thing that they're doing.
Yeah, and speaking of going fast and hard and actually getting some things done, I mean, 4 years is not that long of a time frame. And right. we've been discussing over the first 4 months of the Trump administration that Congress doesn't seem to have that same sense of urgency. Right. And, you know, you've been in Congress under Speaker Johnson's leadership and now seeing the difficulty, frankly, because there is such a very slim majority. There isn't a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And yet it doesn't seem like Congress is focusing on some of these priorities as much as the Trump administration is. And there does seem to be a little bit of disconnect in some of those priorities, especially among Republicans. Like when we're talking about, you know, proxy voting instead of other things that we could, like eliminating income tax, for example, or, you know, any of these things about judicial reform, you know, looking at the Judiciary Act, a lot of these things that could have significant long-term benefits to Americans. Why, in your view, having been there, isn't Congress as focused on what they should be?
In a word, because most members of Congress want to be in Congress, and that is their priority. Their priority is to be in Congress, to stay in Congress, to win re-election, to get campaign dollars, to die in Congress, ideally. That is their priority. And we know who the Democrats are. We know that they're communists, they're Marxists, they're anti-America, they're anti-Constitution, they're anti our founding principles, they're anti-God, they're anti-Judeo-Christian values. We know who the Democrats are. But it's the Republicans who let us down time and again, who they should be going bold and courageous because of the midterms a year and a half from now. They shouldn't be careful and circumspect and cautious because of the midterms. They should say, you know what, we don't know what's going to happen in 26, so we need to get it done this year. And what did they do? On the CR, they passed the CR, keeping all the Biden, Pelosi, Schumer policies and spending levels in place with the promise that the administration wouldn't spend all the money. Now they passed the Senate version of the reconciliation bill with no spending cuts, with the promise that they're going to do the House version when they actually come together and reconcile the two budget resolutions and true reconciliation with the House version, because the Freedom Caucus called for $2 trillion in spending cuts. Then there's the promise that they're going to pass their 12 appropriation bills and really cut spending between now and the end of September when those are due. They're going to pass all 12. It's always the promise of tomorrow. It's never the delivery of today. And the president and the speaker and Senator Thune need to use all of their power to pressure the moderates, the centrists, if you will, the swing district Republicans, say, hey, we got to go big and we got to go bold because we have no guarantee of next year what will happen in those elections. We got to deliver what the American people must do and stop threatening and, you know, the Rand Pauls and the Thomas Massey's, and instead threaten the moderates to get on board, because that's what the American people elected the Republican Party to do. It's all about the dollars. It's all about cutting spending. We got a $2 trillion deficit. We had the second largest deficit in the history of the country outside of COVID was last year. And the Republicans have to deliver now on cutting spending and shrinking government.
Absolutely. And do you think that Trump is willing to spend a significant portion of his political capital on these priorities, where he seems to be willing to spend his political capital elsewhere on things like tariffs and the economy, but not as much in pressuring the moderates?
Well, I am very concerned that most of the talk is about tax cuts and it is about immigration and it is about growing the economy. And those are all important. But the debt is an existential threat to the country, and we're not hearing many Republicans talk about actually reducing the debt and cutting spending. And matter of fact, you've got Republicans like Josh Hawley in the Senate and other Republicans in the House saying, we will not vote for anything that cuts Medicaid. It cuts Medicaid benefits. Well, Medicaid has exploded. It's the fastest growing exploding entitlement program. And we're now reimbursing 90% of the state costs from the federal budgets, reimbursing states 90% instead of the 50% it was pre-COVID, or pre-Obamacare, I should say. That's unsustainable. We've got to have work requirements and get able-bodied working class, working-age Americans off of Medicaid, off of welfare. You've got to cut benefits. We got to save Social Security and Medicare. It's not just about waste, fraud, and abuse. You got to cut things that are popular because they're bankrupt in the country, and it's unsustainable.
Yeah, so well said, and you're absolutely right, Representative Good, that it's always the promise of tomorrow. It's never, this is what we're going to do today, and there's always a reason to kick the can down the road and say, well, we can't do it now because, or there's another election coming up, or because of the media, or all of these other excuses. But right. The reality is that Congress does need to, and the leadership in Congress needs to push for this. And we also need to, as a coalition just of Americans, also look at the primaries and say, okay, we need to make sure that maybe we primary some of these moderates and we get a better coalition of conservatives that will actually step up and do what they were elected to do instead of simply making all of those excuses. But Bob Good, always appreciate your time. You can follow him on X as well. I'd encourage you to do that. And we will be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. Will you take a moment and celebrate life with me? Last year, Preborn helped to rescue over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, this is Jenna Ellis, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 babies are taking their first breath now because of you. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to a woman as she was deciding about the future of her child. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet heartbeat, her baby's chance at life doubled. But Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Christ. Last year, Preborn Network clinics saw 8,900 women receive salvation. Your help is crucial to continue their life-saving work. Your caring, tax-deductible donation saves lives, so please be generous. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR, or dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Your love can save a life.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back, and HHS Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is already raising a lot of issues for some who are talking about his first news conference on autism, because he said Wednesday that the rising rates of autism prevalence in the U.S. reflect a quote-unquote preventable crisis level epidemic that has been caused by an environmental toxin. So advocates for people with autism, and this is coming from CNN, have criticized this position as harmful and misleading. Existing research has explained autism as a multifactorial condition that is influenced heavily by genetics. So even some conservatives are kind of taking issue with this. Bethany Mandel, who's the wife of Seth Mandel, and they're kind of prevalent on X and talk in some of these channels and communities. She posted this: America is realizing that within the autism community, it's a spectrum, rainbow emoji. For a conservative. On one end, parents of kids who 20 years ago would have been called weird, but who proudly wear the label for actual neurodivergence. On the other, parents suffering and dealing with significant issues. So I want to focus on this term neurodivergence because, and this is according to ChatGPT, which you all know that I love, but so what is neurodivergence if you've heard that term? ChatGPT says this: Divergence refers to differences in brain function and behavioral traits that fall outside of what is typically considered quote-unquote neurotypical. The term is commonly used to describe individuals whose neurological development and functioning diverge from societal norms in ways that affect learning, attention, mood, social interaction, or perception. So the term originated in the 1990s as part of the neurodiversity movement, which advocates for viewing these differences as part of the normal variation of human cognition, not inherently pathological or something that needs to be fixed. So what's interesting about this definition and where I see a problem with this in terms of where Kennedy is going and the response to it, ultimately, I think Kennedy's correct, actually, to say that if we can find a cure for autism, then we should. This is something that it's not a spectrum. And this is where a lot of these types of spectrums that the left is pushing are ultimately part of queer theory, where it's gender is on a spectrum, right? There's nothing that you can actually pin down as normative in terms of the biological reality that God ordained and how he creates human beings in his image. It's just that we have all of this divergence, and when people are on a spectrum, it's only this societal norm, and you get into kind of the Marxist type theories of this systemic type of either whether it's racism, it's sexism, it's now maybe, you know, neurodivergence-ism. But to say that there really isn't a normative standard that we can uphold and strive toward, to say that when there is a divergence from that, then it is ultimately a problem. Not that we ostracize those people from our community, or we say, or we call them weird, anything like that, but it's recognizing that there is, in the human realm, there is a normative standard that God himself ordained. And when there are variations from that, it's a result of sin and the fall, and it's a result of the fact that our bodies are not as they were intended to be originally, and we have to deal with that. And so it's not a matter of saying that neurodivergence is a spectrum. It's a matter of recognizing how God created, and then recognizing how can we mitigate the effects of the fall with things like medicine, with things like figuring out, is it in our food supply, figuring out, can we actually help prevent these types of things? So every human being is created in the image of God, has inherent dignity and worth, regardless of where they might deviate from that normative standard. If someone, for example, doesn't have a limb, is born without a limb, we don't say, well, that's just limb divergence. We would say that's a tragedy. And with prosthetics, with advances in medical technology, we can help them live the best life possible, even considering those challenges. So to talk more about this and where, you know, RFK is positioning himself, and then also kind of this backlash, I think, even from the conservative community, is our friend Raw Egg Nationalist. He's an Anon on social, but you can follow him as well. He's the author of the Eggs Benedict Option, health expert, and has a lot of opinions in this particular category about the food supply, and regular listeners know him well. So Raw Egg, good morning, and let's talk about neurodivergence, because I see where RFK Jr. is going with this and suggesting that if we can find a root cause, that's ultimately a benefit for children that are suffering from this, and it's a benefit overall for society.
It's great to be back, Jenna. And this is a very interesting issue. I mean, it's an emotive issue. And I think, first of all, we have to remember that, you know, any issue that involves children and the health of children, the flourishing of children, is going to get people worked up. And you know, the massive prevalence of autism and what to do about, or the growing prevalence of autism and what to do about it, is one of these very emotive issues. And I think, yes, first of all, what you get is you get this kind of initially kind of plausible, emotive, moral argument where anybody who says that there might be, let's say, a cure for autism is basically saying that autistic people's lives don't matter. And that's what people are saying about RFK. They're saying that because he says that autism is a devastating diagnosis and that it ruins families' lives and it blights the lives of children, they're saying that somehow he's almost like a eugenicist, you know, who doesn't want autistic people to exist.
Which is crazy, of course. That's like saying, yeah, if we want to find a cure for cancer, then we're suggesting that anyone with cancer isn't valuable, exactly, as a human being. So that's not rational.
No, exactly, it's not. But people scream it out loud. And so you had, for example, Gwen Waltz, Tim Waltz's wife, saying on Twitter on Thursday in response to RFK's press conference, "This is deeply upsetting, especially coming from our nation's highest ranking health official. Individuals with autism are family, neighbors, students, and co-workers, and they contribute more to this nation than this man ever will." So that's kind of like, that's that viewpoint, you know, expressed by someone in a very prominent position. And a lot of people buy that. But no, like you say, I mean, you can acknowledge that children with autism are gifts from God, that they have an inherent dignity, and that their parents love them, and that we should look after them and value them, but also say that autism is a devastating thing, because it is, especially in the more serious forms. Now, this is where we get into the neurodivergence issue, there are different kinds of autism. There are very serious kinds of autism where children basically can't function, where they're banging their heads against walls and screaming, and, you know, they will never live an independent life. And then you have what are known as high functioning autists, people who basically can live a normal life. But yes, they're different, and their difference will be visible in certain areas, and in other areas, maybe, you know, they can function completely normally and have jobs, etc. But I mean, I think that what RFK Jr. is doing is backed up by scientific evidence. You know, yes, there's been a lot of focus on the genetic elements of autism, and there I think there is a genetic element clearly, but he's talking about the environmental factors, and there's strong evidence, for example, as RFK mentioned, that exposure to molds, fungal overgrowth within the gut, so that's gut dysbiosis, may very well be driving autism cases. So there's some interesting studies that have shown, for example, that young children who have autism and don't respond to treatment, conventional forms of treatment and therapy, may actually end up being cured of their symptoms through the administration of antifungal medicine. So they've got fungal overgrowth in their gut, and it's affecting the production of neurotransmitters in the body. We know that the gut, well, they call the gut the second brain. Basically, we're starting to understand that the gut is intimately linked to the brain, to overall health, to neural function. So yes, mold might be a cause. Gluten intolerance, an intolerance to milk protein, that's another potential factor. That's there's very good evidence to believe that actually, you know, a lot of children with autism are seriously intolerant to certain forms of protein found, gluten particularly, in wheat, and casein in milk proteins and milk products, and that actually cessation of consuming these proteins can almost totally eliminate all symptoms. So, I mean, yeah, he's not, RFK Jr. hasn't plucked this idea out of thin air. There's plenty of scientific backing for the notion that actually autism is linked in certain cases, maybe not all. And this, again, I think it's a spectrum. I think there are probably multiple causes. And so getting to the bottom of it with a serious investigation that actually considers, you know, the impact of various different factors on autism diagnoses and also on the seriousness of autism symptoms, it makes perfect sense to me. I can see that it's an emotive issue, but it makes perfect sense. And I don't think RFK Jr. is doing anything wrong. In fact, I think he's doing something right, very right.
Yeah, and I think you're very right to say that it is an emotionally laden issue, especially for parents who have children with these types of challenges. But what I don't understand about the backlash against RFK is maybe they're saying, okay, he's not approaching this with quite the delicate tones that they might prefer. But when Bethany Mandel is posting, for example, in this same thread, she says, I've never appreciated how RFK has lumped them, like children with autism, in altogether, talking about how autism is something that was caused by parents' actions, what children were exposed to, or that it could be cured. One would have hoped he would have been more sensitive in his new role. That presumption is that there isn't a cure. And even for, you know, some other, you know, type of deficiency like Down syndrome, for example. I mean, the pro-life community for years have always said that that is not a reason to abort a child, obviously. But if there is a cure for that, then of course we should want to make children as healthy as they can, both mentally and physically. And so why is it that somebody, not necessarily Bethany Mandel specifically, but, you know, people like her, who are actually rejecting this idea that they don't even want to consider the possibility that there is a cure, and that RFK Jr. might be right about some of these things, and with more research, we could figure it out.
Yeah, I think it's simply a case of very faulty moral thinking and misguided, a kind of misguided sense of being right. You know, like I say, they think that actually you can't. If you start to talk about causes, if you start to talk about it as a curable condition, what you're actually saying is that the people themselves just shouldn't exist. And like I say, I mean, that's not, you know, it's done under the guise actually of reducing suffering. But surely if you're going to make a utilitarian calculus about levels of suffering in the world, wouldn't reducing the number of autism sufferers increase the total amount of happiness? I mean, it doesn't really bear a great deal of scrutiny, but it has this emotional hold, especially on liberals, but also actually, I think, like you say, on a certain segment of the conservative audience as well. And so I think it will be important actually for RFK Jr. to pay attention to the kind of messaging that he uses, maybe not to tone it down, but just to make the argument in a different way, and also to emphasize the fact that he's not saying, you know, he's not making some kind of eugenic argument about eliminating all autism sufferers from the world, including living autism sufferers, but actually saying, you know, if this is a curable, if this is a curable condition, if we can alleviate this suffering, then we should, because that's good.
Yes, exactly. And that's where his whole focus, as I see it with HHS, is to make America healthy again, which is literally his slogan, and doing that in a way that isn't just over-medicating and saying we should be so reliant on pharmaceuticals. It's saying let's go back to the original root cause and see why, as he testified in his confirmation hearings, to say that, you know, back the difference between back in the 1960s versus now, you see so many more people with chronic illnesses, and then they take medication and then need more medication to deal with the symptoms, you know, based on that, the first series of medications. And so to see how many people are taking so many drugs in society, when we could say, well, let's look at the food supply, let's look at the dyes that are in the food supply, let's look at all of these other environmental factors. If we could reduce the cause, then we wouldn't just be treating the symptoms. And that should be a goal that everyone can get on board with. If HHS, which, you know, in my view is kind of an unconstitutional division anyway. I mean, most federal agencies have no business existing anyway, but if we're going to have an HHS, this is the best way to utilize that functionality from the federal level.
Yes, absolutely. And something very interesting actually happened over the weekend or late last week, which was at the FDA. Marty Makary, who is the new FDA commissioner, said that pharmaceutical representatives would no longer be allowed to sit on FDA advisory boards. Now, that's a very, very important step towards decoupling the regulatory industries from the industries they're supposed to be regulating. They've been too cozy. They're in bed together. You know, these vested interests have too much power in determining the scope of health investigations, the scope of regulations, and, you know, RFK Jr. and people under him, Marty Makary, others, are actually starting to do something about that. It's a big task, and like you say, you know, the whole focus really of these departments of government with massive budgets, with massive powers over healthcare and the food supply, has been really not to address the underlying causes. And you know, RFK Jr. has been very, very clear throughout his career that there needs to be a different approach, and it actually looks like he's starting to implement that approach now. We've got this food dye ban that's going to come in 2026. That's fantastic. RFK's also talked about fundamentally reforming, even overhauling, the FDA's system of licensing food additives that's generally recognized as safe, GRAS. Which is a system that's totally out of control and has allowed an unknown number of food additives into the food supply, maybe 10,000 in the US by comparison with about 2,000 in the EU. So, the fundamental focus, I think, of the next 4 years, and indeed of MAHA as a kind of multi-term agenda, has to be the underlying causes of ill health, the underlying causes of this enormous suffering that has overtaken America and has blighted the lives of Americans now for decades.
Well said. And I've really been looking forward to this segment, Raw Egg. And I appreciate so much the way that you approach this, because you're absolutely right. It is an emotional issue that we do need to separate the emotion from the facts and from the best practices for not only the federal government looking at this through HHS, but also, you know, for parents and how we can hopefully get to the cause of some of these things and help everyone live healthier lives. So this will be an ongoing conversation, but ultimately for listeners, I want you to always think about these terms that like neurodivergence and really consider what is the root of what they're actually saying, and does that remain consistent with the biblical worldview and what we know about how God created human beings and the subject of anthropology as a subset of theology. So we'll be right back with more.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And this coming from Town Hall, in another major shakeup within the Trump administration, Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced a sweeping reorganization of the State Department aiming to cut over 700 positions and eliminate 132 of its 734 bureaus, a 15% reduction in personnel. This overhaul seeks to refocus the department on core national interests and regional diplomacy, moving away from promoting liberal ideologies. Rubio criticized certain offices for advancing left-wing agendas at taxpayer expense. The restructuring also hints at reducing or closing overseas missions and folding liberal values initiatives into regional bureaus. Although no layoffs are expected immediately, a senior State Department official indicated that job losses are likely, and you would think if 700 are being eliminated. So let's welcome in Gerard Folletti, who is senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. And Gerard, it seems like from a multifaceted approach, the Trump administration is looking to not only tamper back the administration's bulk of not just their own administration, but overall the federal government, reduce spending and all of this, but they're looking at basically every agency, and each secretary is looking at cutting back a lot of these implicit liberal positionings like the DEI initiatives and all of this wasteful spending that we saw from DOGE as well. This would be a really good thing for the State Department, I think.
It's an absolutely terrific thing for the State Department, but the State Department has one big disadvantage versus every other government department. There, the anti-American, anti-Republican bias has been prevalent for decades. The State Department is perhaps one of the most corrupt when it comes to being captured by the bureaucracy in the U.S. government. And it's fair to say that a lot of what it has done overseas in its missions has been contrary to American policy, has been actually appeasing whether it's local warlords or helping economies in the Middle East add to the disadvantage of America. So it's really important, I think, that Rubio is now focusing on the State Department and eliminating some of these positions, these programs, and these missions, because they've not served American interests. To the contrary, they've served ideology that has made America more of a minor player on the global stage, not the predominant one.
And so and that's a great point. And can we expect any type of litigation like we've seen in other avenues where the Trump administration has tried to eliminate some of these positions and having these some of these leftist judges basically saying, well, it doesn't matter that you're the chief executive. You can't fire people or eliminate some of these positions. Do we expect that with something like this in the State Department specifically?
Well, over the last 10 years, I think we've come to expect lawfare with anything Donald Trump does. So I guess there will be lawsuits filed. But I don't think that they will go anywhere. I think that the courts have been increasingly siding with the administration in terms of its ability to fire people. And what makes the State Department unique is that foreign policy is one of those core functions of the presidency. It's harder for people to argue that there is congressional oversight that's needed in personnel changes when it comes to foreign policy or foreign agencies. So I think that the administration has much more of a free hand to reorganize the State Department than it does perhaps other domestic agencies.
And I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who's the senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. And what ideally would this look like if this is just the start with Rubio and the State Department? What ideally would be the best areas to focus on? I mean, in just in my experience in the first Trump administration, there was so much out of the State Department that was very globalist in worldview, that facilitated a lot of the liberal and leftist policies on, you know, LGBTQ nonsense, and was really part of an arm that almost undermined the Trump administration's original goals.
I think we've come to the expectation in 2025 that one of the main aims of foreign service of the State Department is to pursue American interests overseas, including especially in the economy. It's opening those doors to the American economy. It's opening those doors to American businesses. So I think that what we can hope for in a reorganization is that there will be more of a business focus on breaking down barriers to trade, breaking down barriers to American entry into global markets, rather than pursuing these DEI initiatives or pursuing, you know, LGBTQ theater studies in Ghana, which are, we've seen that under USAID, and that's something that the State Department has now taken over, although it's cutting those programs. But we don't want the State Department to be engaged in programs that do nothing for American interests. We want America to succeed economically first and foremost, and I think we will see Trump reorganize in that direction.
And hopefully this will lend itself to a little bit of a smoother pathway than some of his other changes that he wants from other agencies, which brings me to a Hill article. A judge orders Trump administration to restore the Voice of America. So a federal judge on Tuesday found the Trump administration's efforts to dismantle a VOA, or the Voice of America, and an affiliated news service likely was unlawful, indefinitely blocking the shuttering of the government-funded news outlet and affiliated services. So this U.S. district judge ordered VOA's parent agency, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, to restore VOA and other outlets under their umbrella and barred the agency from preventing them from serving as, quote, a consistently reliable and authoritative news source as required by law. So this also seems like another ridiculous judicial power grab, and this doesn't seem like a judge should be able to override the administration trying to shutter Voice of America and dismantling this, especially when it's taxpayer funded. And frankly, before, you know, this became a news item, and Carrie Lake was appointed, you know, the head of VOA, and of course that got kind of a splash all over social media. I hadn't even heard of Voice of America. I mean, this isn't something that anybody is necessarily relying on. But what is this judge doing, and how can he have jurisdiction over this to thwart and block the shuttering of this news service?
Well, the jurisdiction problem is one that we're seeing over and over again with district court judges that are basically trying to put nationwide orders in place, especially when it comes to shuttering agencies and grabbing power where they don't seem to have any. But ultimately, I do think that what we're seeing increasingly is the courts are sending Donald Trump a message that ultimately, what he's doing is probably okay, but he needs to follow more process. The administration needs to follow more process than it has been. I think a lot of these cases are relying on the Administrative Procedures Act. They're relying on mechanisms for shutting things down and saying that there needs to be a mechanism in place, not that he shouldn't or couldn't do it, just the manner in which he's doing it. So I think ultimately he will be able to shutter these departments. I will say, though, that Voice of America, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, these were very important outlets back during the Cold War. They were America's presence in Europe. They were actually the bastions of freedom and spreading the message about American democracy around the world. The problem is that after the Cold War, these have become infiltrated by woke ideology and have started presenting programming that's not really reflective of American values. So perhaps the better play is to reform these organizations, to continue broadcasting to the Third World, to the Middle East, to Chinese Communist Asia, to spread the message of American democracy and American prowess in the economy instead of DEI initiatives on these channels.
Yeah, and it just seems like VOA, along with a host of other agencies that may have originally had a good purpose at their inception, have now just become tools of the left to push their own ideology. And that's what the Trump administration is recontemplating. And so would they be wise to look at the process and basically not give some of these leftist judges a reason to say, well, you didn't follow the process, and so that they're not even necessarily reaching the merits here? They're just it sounds like the Trump administration may be giving these judges a reason to indefinitely block what they ultimately want to do. And if they were just a little bit smarter, perhaps, in following the process, then it would be a lot more difficult for these activist judges to thwart that ultimate outcome.
Well, you're exactly right. It's not much different with deportations. I mean, what you need to give people is a notice and an opportunity to be heard. It doesn't mean that you'll rule in their favor or keep them in the country. It doesn't mean that if you give people a 30-day comment window on a proposal to close an agency that you'll decide anything differently. But it's following that process that adds a little bit more time, but insulates these decisions from court challenge. So I think the Trump administration would be prudent in many of these cases to look more closely at the procedures that are in play and actually follow them, and to avoid these legal challenges that we're seeing taking up so much time and attention.
Yeah, and hopefully there are some good lawyers on the Trump administration side that's looking at this and seeing what these judges' orders are saying, and then trying to prevent that line of attack, and are looking at the processes and saying, okay, maybe it'll take a couple more steps and we won't be able to get to the outcome quite as quickly, but still following that process so that this isn't just then caught up in litigation perpetually. And so where is the Trump administration overall on, you know, a lot of these issues that do seem caught up in litigation? Because it seems like somehow all of these district judges, whether it's forum shopping or venue selecting or whatever, it seems like a lot of these district judges at the federal level are holding against the Trump administration instead of some of these judges being at the very least neutral. I mean, neutral would be better than outright hostile or activist.
Well, I think you're right about that, but we also have to see that when these cases do start to go up on appeal, that the appellate courts are narrowing down on and restricting what some of these rulings actually are. So we are seeing Trump being able to exercise some of these cuts, some of these firings, some closures of agencies and programs, because as these cases get appealed, the rulings, the restrictions get narrower and narrower. They apply to a smaller group of people or a smaller group of programs. So Trump is grinding his way through, but the activist judges who jumped on the immediate bandwagon of let's stop Trump at any cost, they still serve as an impediment. We just need to play the process out and get past them in order for Trump to ultimately be successful on a lot of what he's doing.
I'm speaking with Gerard Folletti, who's senior counsel at the Lawfare Project. And before we run out of time, Gerard, I also want to just ask you your thoughts on the Supreme Court's arguments yesterday on the parental opt-out on LGBTQ books in schools. I listened to probably about the first hour of the arguments. And, you know, once again, Justice Sotomayor was such a bully from the bench. I mean, it's so clear when the advocate that is speaking, she doesn't prefer their argument. And so she's hostile. She doesn't let them respond. And it's frankly very annoying, and I think it's very rude from the bench for a justice to treat an advocate that way. But, you know, she's done that for a really long time. But her argument saying that mere exposure for children, and we're talking about kids as young as five, to this type of sexual content doesn't run afoul of religious freedom and free exercise, and more fundamentally, even in this context, I think parental rights to be able to shield your children from content that you don't want them exposed to. That to me was a very alarming position for even a very radical leftist judge or justice on the Supreme Court to take.
Well, it certainly seems very radical, and you're looking at young children who are being exposed to things that, let's leave religion aside for a second, and let's look at the common sense. You don't want young children exposed, you know, sexualized. You don't want them exposed to a lot of this content. You want to preserve their youth and innocence and let the parents decide the age appropriate, because it might be different on each child, period, to start exposing them to things like that. It should not be the province of the school or the government to dictate when. And even without the religious argument, I think that there is a common sense argument to be made about parental knowledge of their children more so than what a school or a government program can institute. But Judge Sotomayor, I mean Justice Sotomayor, she's been doing this for quite a while. She is very aggressive when it comes to some issues. This is one of them. It was not unexpected. But then again, she is, I think, in the minority on this case. And I do think that I'm cautiously optimistic that the court will start giving more deference to parents and parental rights in schools.
Yeah, thankfully, I think you're right that it does appear that she's poised to be in the minority here. And I agree with you. I mean, I think even more than just a religious freedom issue or free exercise issue, this should be much more about parental rights, because children belong to parents. They are not wards of the state for the state to determine and override parental wishes on these types of issues. And, you know, I can imagine if this were a Christian book and content that was directly from the Bible, and somehow then the other side was advocating, well, you know, it's just mere exposure to this, how Sotomayor may have responded, probably the exact opposite. So it just seems like she's always trying to fit her view into the outcome she prefers instead of looking at the right at issue, which on this should be parental rights. But we're going to get into this topic and more in depth into the arguments of this case tomorrow with Corey DeAngelis on why school choice is obviously the solution to this. But Jared Folletti, thanks so much. You can always follow him on X. And as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.